Welcome, Council. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Reyes, Judge Slita, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning. There we go.
Well, as the parties are aware, and for the record, the Minnesota Court of Appeals is declining to hold oral arguments live at the Minnesota Judicial Center here in St. Paul or in other courtrooms outside, outstate, where we typically hold oral argument, including St. Cloud. And we're doing so for the good of the public, the parties, the attorneys, and court staff in light of the ongoing national and Minnesota pandemic state of emergency. We are therefore entertaining this argument by video conferencing, particularly the video conferencing tool WebEx, with none of the judges or the participants in the same precise location, at least not in the same room. The technology is not perfect as a substitute for in-person hearings. And so attorneys should just recognize that. We're likely to have occasional lapses and lag time. So just bear that in mind, that the time that a word is spoken is not necessarily the time that the word is heard by others. So we'll have to be careful with the technology and not talk over each other. But in keeping with due processes, our hearings are still public. And so the audio recording of these proceedings will be available for anyone to hear once the recording is uploaded to the judiciary's website, as are our oral arguments generally. The parties should be clear on this. The rules of presentation have not changed. Each party, therefore, will have 15 minutes to present the argument on behalf of your client, with an additional 5 minutes of time for rebuttal for appellant's counsel, if you'd like to use the time for that purpose. The case that we are hearing now is Off v. Off, now known as Dodson. Counsel, please state your name as you begin each leg of the argument, because we do keep track of the who's making which argument in the audio recording of things. And with that, counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you have the virtual floor.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning, and may it please the court and counsel. My name is Lindsay Forsgren, and I am the attorney for the appellant, Sandra Dodgson, formerly known as Sandra Off. My client is before this court today appealing the decision of the Ottertail County District Court, as the decision of the district court is not fair and equitable under the circumstances. Specifically, my client is bringing to this court's attention the property equalization payment she was ordered to pay, which is related to decisions of both marital debt and marital equity. The first item I'd like to discuss today is the equity in the Fergus Falls home. Now, it was the very clear intent of the parties that Ms. Dodgson have the Fergus Falls home, and they made that clear through their actions, both financial and with signing of deeds. Ms. Dodgson had a home in Park Rapids before the parties were married. That home was sold, and she no longer had a home in Minnesota near her family. So they made the decision to purchase a home in Minnesota so that she could be closer to her family. And in making this decision, they intended for both parties to receive an equal share of the marital estate, which Mr. Off accepted in cash and deposited into his own personal account. As the Your Honors are aware from reviewing the briefs, the parties did keep sort of his, hers, and ours accounts. You know, they had the ours accounts, which were related to the joint business, and they would essentially pay themselves out of this joint account and deposit it into their separate accounts. Now, what they did is they took approximately $37,000, which was given to Ms. Dodgson to make a down payment on her home, and $37,000 was given to Mr. Off, which he accepted, and he admitted this in testimony, and deposited it into his own personal account. Now, I've cited a case for the court, Haverlick v. Haverlick, in which the parties had a very clear intent of what they were doing with specific marital assets. You know, that case is a little different in that they were specifically designating money to be for the education of their children, but that's no different here. They were specifically designating approximately $37,000 per party to do with what they wished. Now, my client chose to take that money, invest it into a home so that she could be closer to her family. And Mr. Off matching this amount to himself, it was the clear intent of the parties that she received more of the marital estate in that sense. The parties intended the home to be Ms. Dodgson's. That's clear because as soon as they were able, they deeded the home to be in Ms. Dodgson's name alone. And if the entire home is not considered to be non-marital, it's the position of my client that at least the approximately $37,000 down payment should be considered non-marital, or that it be the intent of the parties that this be non-marital, and that the Schmitz formula be applied to.
Would you agree that all of the discussion that you've just presented depends upon, in part, the credibility of the parties and the testimony that the court received, and that you're essentially making an argument based, challenging essentially the fact finding of the district court as opposed to the legal conclusions of the district court?
Yes, I think, Your Honor, that it would go to the credibility of the parties because we are very much arguing intent here. I think it was pretty clear what the intent of the parties was, which was why they did that division of essentially marital division of assets at that time.
Well, that's the part that I'm struggling with a bit, that you're saying it appears to you that it's clear what the intent of the parties was, but recognizing that the district court heard conflicting testimony on that question, on what basis would we say that there was no evidence, no testimony to reach a conclusion other than the one that you are proposing as a matter of fact?
Well, Your Honor, I would disagree that there was conflicting testimony because Mr. Off did in fact recognize that division of money, you know, and there is a documentation to support the claim because as I stated, the parties did deed the house to be in Ms. Dodgson.
I'm referring to the factual question of intent, not the testimony about the money that was exchanged.
Sure. I don't know that I'm quite grasping the question, Your Honor. I apologize.
Well, are you saying that the facts are undisputed and that Mr. Off conceded the intent that you're saying the district court should have determined as a matter of fact?
Well, I do think that through testimony, Mr. Off did concede that intent.
And what is the specific testimony that you're referring to establishing as a matter of law or as a matter of fact that he certainly conceded the intent that you believe the district court erroneously failed to ascribe to the parties?
Sure. There's testimony in the transcript in which Mr. Off did concede that the parties decided together to purchase the Fergus Falls home, and I believe, I can't quote it exactly, but he said something along the lines of, so that's what we did, we bought the Fergus Falls house, she did. We gave the down payment to her to purchase that house, and I actually matched that to myself. You know, so that testimony to me speaks loud and clear that he understood that the party's intent was for this home to belong to Ms. Dodgson.
But that's an inference that you're drawing from that testimony. It's not direct evidence of intent.
I suppose that's true, Your Honor. I mean, nobody's gonna sit on the stand and just straight admit that they're not entitled to $37,000, but I think that it's a very strong inference that can be drawn from that testimony and from documentation that was also provided to the court.
But doesn't that ultimately still go to a credibility determination that the district court would have to make as to what the party's intent was?
You know, Your Honor, I think that's true. And I think that's with my other two discussions that I have prepared regarding the Arizona home and the HELOC, I would like to discuss with the court why I think Mr. Off's credibility should have been assessed differently, as there were several areas in which he was very dishonest with the court and with Ms. Dodgson.
Well, I certainly appreciate that, and you know, the argument that you're making now, and then the argument that had been made at the district court as to whether or not he's credible. But on appeal, we defer to the district court's credibility determinations, and we don't reweigh the evidence on appeal. But it sounds like that's what you're essentially asking us to do.
You know, Your Honor, I'm asking the court to look at the facts. And, you know, the court has, this court specifically has the power to make, to exercise independent judgment with respect to non-marital and marital equity. You know, you have the broad discretion to look at marital equity and make the determination of whether it was properly calculated or whether more non-marital equity should have been credited or whether any non-marital equity should have been credited.
Do we have discretion to reweigh the district court's credibility determinations on matters of fact?
I think so, Your Honor, particularly
with regard to intent.
I think so, Your Honor, because, you know, the case Campion v. Campion, you know, it specifically says that you can exercise independent judgment with respect to whether property should be characterized as non-marital or marital. And in order to make that independent judgment, and to
Isn't that based upon undisputed facts as opposed to intent of the parties? Your argument seems to rest substantially on, and perhaps rightly, on the question of whether or not the parties came to a meeting of the minds and intended the result that you're advocating at this point. I'm not sure that the case law supports the notion that we can substitute our judgment for the district courts on credibility determinations, particularly on inferences that are drawn to determine parties' intent. But you can correct me if you have a case that refutes my assumption.
Your Honor, I don't have specific case law that refutes that. All I can say is that case law, family law specifically, is very circumstantial and fact specific, and every family law case is different. What I would say is that the case law supports my client in stating that the outcome should be fair and equitable, and there's nothing fair and equitable about this decision. When you think of fair and equitable, it's not necessarily a 50-50 split, as the court is aware. When I think of fair and equitable, I think, how are these parties going to be living after the divorce? Once everything is all said and done, do we have a party who's living a lavish lifestyle and traveling the country to play in expensive pickleball and golf tournaments? And then we also have a party who's living off Social Security, juggling bills and selling her own personal property just to pay her monthly bills. Her health continues to deteriorate. You know, if this decision stands, going to be destitute. She's going to.
These are issues that perhaps bear upon spousal maintenance, which I don't believe is before us.
No, Your Honor, there's spousal maintenance not before you, but I do believe that that property equalization payment is unreasonable and it's not fair and equitable, and that the trial court erred in refusing to recognize any of those non-marital claims. I think the stronger claim of the two is the Arizona home, in which her parents specifically gifted her equity over and above the purchase price.
Ms. Forsgren, on that issue with regard to the Mesa home, the court made specific findings. This gets back perhaps also to credibility, but in any event, even absent credibility, isn't it true there is no specific evidence of a gift other than the testimony of the parties? So that is the credibility issue, but there was no specific document, and in fact, the court seemed to suggest that even the appraisal values and the negotiating between your client and husband in terms of reducing the price they purchased from your client's parents suggests that it was something other than a gift. Would that also not be purely a factual finding? We could not, there'd be no basis, or if there is, could you point to a particular basis in the record that the court erred in making a finding that it was not evidence of a gift?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that the determinations the court made were erroneous in that it relied at least in part on a 2006 letter and a 2011 will, which predated and postdated the sale respectively, both of which are completely irrelevant. You know, there's no law stating that we have to put a gift in writing, that we have to do a gift tax return for a gift of this size. You know, we had very convincing testimony from Ms. Stronkowski about conversations she had with her grandmother, recalling very specific details in which her grandmother made it very clear it was her intent that this be a gift to Miss Dodgson for everything that she had done for them over the years, and because she wanted the home to stay in the family. And that's even further evidenced by the fact that it was left fully furnished. And in fact, Mr. Off was deceitful in that he acknowledged that he understood her understanding that the house was purchased at a discounted price, and anything over and above that discounted price was to be a gift. She stated that, and he did nothing to correct that up until the trial.
Ms. Forsgren, wouldn't your client also have to overcome the fact, though, that even assuming a gift, that it was a gift during marriage, your client and husband were married at the time it was given. So even if, although the court seemed not to accept this argument, but even if the record supported a gift of some value, would not your client have to overcome evidence that it's a marital gift?
Yes, Your Honor, and I did distinguish for the court in my brief, Olson v. Olson. There was no testimony in this case that the gift was intended for both parties. And in fact, Mr. Off acknowledged that he hardly had a relationship with Ms. Dodgson's parents, that they knew him only as Sandra's husband. It was very clear in conversations, you know, unfortunately, her parents are no longer around to establish this and offer this testimony for the court. But the evidence and the testimony that was offered very clearly established that this was intended to be a gift to Sandra. And Mr. Off acknowledged that.
It seems like we're facing the same issue here of it seems to rely more on testimony rather than documentation. And to Judge Slater's point with respect to even if it were to be construed as a gift during marriage, it's construed, there's a presumption that it's a gift to both parties. Is there any documentation at all to refute that presumption?
No, Your Honor, and that's the issue. There is no documentation to support it one way or the other. All we have is intent. We have testimony and we have the donative intent, which I think can be strongly inferred from the actions of the parties and from the nature of the sale. You know, Sandra specifically worked out the negotiations with her parents. It was offered at $120,000. She indicated that it was not feasible, and so they discounted it even further. And I do see that my time is almost up. May I offer a quick summary of my argument?
You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal time. Your argument's well briefed, and if there's more you'd like to add, you can do so during that period.
All right, thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for respondent.
Oh, can you hear me, Your Honors?
We can.
Okay, sounds great. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mary Casa, and I represent Donald Henryoff Sr. in this appeal. Your Honors, an abuse of discretion does not exist in this case. The district court divided the parties' marital assets and debts evenly because that is what it was required to do under Minnesota Statute Section 518.58. Appellant is not entitled to a non-marital claim in the Mesa home because the record is devoid of any evidence, let alone evidence that is clear and convincing that there was a valid gift from appellant's parents to appellant alone. Nor is appellant entitled to a non-marital claim in the Fergus Falls home because there is no evidence on the record to suggest that respondent spent his equal distribution of marital funds on anything but marital expenses. No authority exists to support appellant's claim that marital funds are transformed into non-marital funds simply because each party decided they would each receive a distribution of marital funds and that they would be allowed to spend it in different ways. Finally, the district court appropriately found that each party was equally liable for the HELOC debt. The credibility determinations of both parties and appellant's self-generated QuickBook records. For each of the three issues, the district court carefully weighed each witness's testimony. It reviewed all the exhibits, and it logically and reasonably decided that the marital estate should be divided equally amongst the parties. That decision should not now be disturbed on appeal. The first issue that appellant raised in its brief is that the district court abused its discretion by not awarding appellant a non-marital interest in the Mesa home. Based upon the plethora of documentary evidence on the record, coupled with the conflicting testimony provided by all four witnesses at trial on this specific issue, an abuse of discretion cannot be found. In general, all property acquired post-marriage and pre-valuation date is presumed to be marital property pursuant to Minnesota Statutes 518.003, Subdivision 3B. If a party wishes to overcome this presumption and claim a non-marital interest in the party and the property, the party must prove the underlying facts by a preponderance of evidence. That standard changes, however, when the claimed non-marital property is alleged to be a gift or inheritance from a third party to only one of the spouses. McCulloch v. McCulloch establishes the rule that the party claiming the non-marital property by way of a gift must establish by clear and convincing evidence that there was one, donative intent, two, delivery of the gift, and three, absolute disposition of the property. Olson v. Olson also provides clear guidance on this issue and held that the most important factor in determining whether a gift is marital or non-marital is the donor's intent. This is an issue of fact. Olson establishes the rule that donative intent is demonstrated by the surrounding circumstances, which includes the form of transfer as one of those circumstances. In Olson, the evidence was insufficient to overcome the property's marital character, even though there was testimony from the donor himself as to his own intent for transferring the property. Rather, the documentary evidence in that case was conclusive to show that the donor's intent was to gift the property to both spouses. In the case at hand, there was no testimony. There was no testimony.
That was me. I'm sorry. I was going to say something, but go ahead. Continue.
Okay, thank you. In the case at hand, there was no testimony from the donors because they are deceased. All the documentary evidence in the record supports the claim that the Mesa property is marital. First, there was the 2011 will of appellant's mother, which indicated that each of her children were to receive a general 25% distribution of the estate. There was the 2006 letter from appellant's mother to her children as well, which provided information and instructions to her children as to how she and her husband preferred her children to handle their estates once they passed away. When these two documents, which are the only two documents actually evidencing either of appellant's parents' intent or wishes regarding the handling of their estate are considered collectively, it can be concluded that no living inheritance existed.
Ms. Casa, and Ms. Forsgren points this out, that it would seem of minimal relevance, if any. Their argument is no relevance to any documents post, because obviously if indeed, as they point out, a gift had already been made, it's already calculated into distribution. What's the main argument you make with regard to documentary evidence when it's all after the fact?
Sure, Your Honor. With regards to the will, the 2011 will, which was after the fact, I believe it goes to show that when considered collectively, it's the only documentary evidence on the record, and you would think that, and I believe that's important to demonstrate intent when there is no other evidence. And when that documentary evidence is also considered with other documentation, such as the 2011 comparable properties search, as well as the 2015 property valuation notice, I believe that taken together collectively, that indicates that there was no intent for either party or for appellant to receive a gift from her parents exclusive of her husband. Finally, there's also the disclaimer that appellant signed at the time of the sale, stating that the Mesa property is the sole and separate property of the respondent. It also stated that appellant had no past or present right, title, interest, claim, or lien in or to against the Mesa property. Finally, that disclaimer said that the sole purpose of the disclaimer was to make a clear record that appellant had zero claim or interest in the Mesa property. That document was signed and notarized on July 2nd, 2010. The sale of the Mesa home to respondent alone was completed by July 8th, 2010. Although appellant claims that she had no idea what she was signing at the time, and that respondent lied to her about what it was, the fact is the district court disagreed when it made a credibility determination on this issue. In contrast to all of this documentary,
Ms. Casa, did the court make, in your opinion, adequate factual findings to distinguish the granddaughter? It seemed like the granddaughter was the one in particular outside of the parties who would support the wife's position with regard to the intent of the grandparents. Do you believe the intent apparently, by her opinion, indeed was consistent with the argument now being made? Do you believe the court made sufficient factual findings as to why it did not find her testimony credible?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. Based on the specific mention that Ms. Strankowski is a licensed attorney in two states, albeit not Arizona. She also works for a federal judge, and in fact, her testimony provides that She did ethically provide advice, and she was told that she was allowed to do so so long as she did not feel she would be brought before court. I mean, so in my opinion, you have any 1L law student would know that if you're going to have a scenario where you have grandparents saying they're going to want to make a gift, you're going to want to memorialize it. I'm not saying that she needs to go off and do it for them, but I would argue that, you know, if you get to a point where the property is being transferred solely to respondent, which it was, and the daughter and attorney knew that this was being transferred solely to the respondent, you would, I believe that the credible argument would be that she should have made sure that her mother found it some sort of writing, even if it was a letter or something, indicating that there was a gift from her parents to appellant alone. Based upon all of the documentary evidence at trial, as well as the testimony, logic and reason required the district court to find the appellant does not have a non-marital claim in the Mason property. An abuse of discretion did not occur, and the court must affirm the district court's decision. Appellant's second issue on appeal is that the district court erred in finding that appellant was not entitled to a non-marital claim in the Fergus Falls property. Appellant is asking the court to find that she is entitled to a non-marital claim in the Fergus Falls property because the parties each agreed to receive a $37,000 distribution of marital funds, and they were allowed to spend it as they saw fit. Just as the district court expressly noted in its decision, appellant cites no authority, nor has any been found, to support its proposition that a marital division of equity somehow results in the property divided being treated as if it were non-marital. Appellant does cite two cases in her initial brief in support of her non-marital claim. However, Haverlick v. Haverlick is not relevant to the facts of this case, as Haverlick in no way discusses how an agreed-upon allocation has any effect on the classification of property as marital or non-marital. As to Lynch versus Lynch, this case is distinguishable in that the parties here each received their distribution of marital funds in 2011, at least 5 years prior to the party's separation. Moreover, there is no evidence in the record to suggest that respondent did not spend his $37,000 distribution on anything but marital expenses, which is something that the district court specifically noted in its decision.
But Ms. Casa, doesn't it seem logical to assume that if each party has, if they're split up and given $37,000 to do what they want, which is very, very common in marriages where couples will do that, they'll say, okay, you get, in this case, it's $37,000. And in my case, it might be, you know, $37, but in any event, for a couple to say, okay, this is your money to do with what you want and you can spend it in any way. Isn't that a strong indication that that money is intended to be non-marital, that each individual and spend it how they want and reap the benefits of that separately?
Your Honor, well, I do believe that each party to a marriage is, of course, entitled to make those agreements. I would like to think if you're going in to purchase something as a house and you're trying to make sure that house is yours, there would be some evidence or documentation showing that non-marital claim is there. And in this case, the property was originally purchased by respondent alone once again, because appellant didn't have the credit history for it. And appellant was also responsible for helping assist with making sure the mortgage payments were made. And I also want to just fall back on my argument that there's no proof to show that the expenses that Mr. Off spent on using his $37,000 distribution weren't marital. That evidence. Hope, Your Honor, you're muted.
Okay, looks like I'm unmuted. I've been told I've been muted before, so this isn't the first time. What do you make of the transfer of ownership? Can you speak to that as to the party's intent? So the purchase was made in his name because of his credit worthiness, but then the later transfer of the property, as I understand it, to her name.
Correct, Your Honor. And I believe that it's the same argument that Should appellant wanted to have claimed a non-marital interest in the Mesa home, knowing that her husband would be the one to have the sole title to it under paperwork and documentation, perhaps she should have evidenced that in some way at the time. I understand that parties, when they're in a marriage, they aren't anticipating divorce, but both of these parties had been married before, and they know what they should have some recognition of how the division of property works, and anticipate that, especially if they're going to make this equitable division. Appellant has not provided any legal basis, nor has she set forth sufficient facts to support her proposition that she's entitled to a non-marital claim in the Fergus Falls home. The district court was well within its discretion when it found that the Fergus Falls home was entirely marital property, and that decision cannot now be disturbed on appeal. Finally, just as the record doesn't support findings that appellant has a non-marital claim to either the Mesa home or the Fergus Falls home, the record does not support a finding that the HELOC debt is respondent's responsibility alone. The HELOC debt is a marital debt that was incurred during the party's marriage to fund the party's business. Thus, appellant was tasked with proving that the debt is non-marital by a preponderance of the evidence. The district court declined to find that appellant's testimony, as well as her self-generated QuickBooks records, were sufficient to meet this burden. That logical and reasonable determination was well within the district court's broad discretion and cannot now be disturbed on appeal. For each of these three issues, appellant has failed to prove that the district court erred by evenly dividing the marital estate. Appellant has failed to show that the district court ignored logic and reason by denying her non-marital claims in the Mesa and Fergus Falls homes, thus resulting in abuse of discretion. Appellant has also failed to show that no other reasonable district court judge could have found the HELOC debt to be a marital debt for which both parties are responsible for. The district court carefully listened to all of the witness testimony at trial, then it reviewed all of the evidence. Then the district court did what it was supposed to do under the law. It divided the marital estate amongst the parties in a just and equitable fashion. Accordingly, respondent now respectfully asks that this court affirm that logical and reasonable decision. Thank you.
Thank you. I believe I'm no longer muted, I hope. Very good. Thank you. Counsel for respondent, you have rebuttal if you'd like.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Lindsay Forsgren, attorney for appellant, offering rebuttal. First, I'd like to address the disclaimer that Ms. Casa brought up. I think that this just further shows the misrepresentations and deceitfulness of the respondent throughout the relationship. To ask your spouse to sign something, which she was not aware what she was signing, but to have her sign something that completely disclaims her interest in a home that's been in her family since before the parties were married, before they even met, is just deceitful. And it goes along with the $50,000 that he claims to have invested of his own non-marital money up until the trial, at which time he admitted in sworn testimony that he did not contribute that $50,000, that it in fact came from the joint account. Your Honors, he continues to make that misrepresentation to you. He's included in his brief that the $50,000 he had contributed was his own, but that he's no longer pursuing that non-marital claim.
Can you clarify? You lost me a little bit in your argument. When you said it was deceitful, what are you saying that was deceitful?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe it was deceitful that he had his spouse sign a document which she didn't understand what she was signing that would disclaim her interest in the home that's been in her family. She wasn't aware of this document until divorce proceedings, wasn't aware of what it meant. She wasn't aware that Mr. Off didn't even give $50,000 of his own premarital money until divorce proceedings, at which time it came to light that that money, in fact, came from the joint account.
Did the district court find that that this was, as you put it, deceitful?
The district court did not use the word deceitful, no, Your Honor. The district court just, in fact, acknowledged that he did not have a non-marital claim.
And that on what basis would we be able to rest our opinion on the premise that you've just asserted, which was that he was acting deceitfully, intending to mislead?
Your Honor, I think the importance of the deceitfulness and in a few other areas as well, as it goes to the credibility of Mr. Off as a witness, I think that a lot of the determinations that were made in this case were based on credibility and testimony. And Mr. Off just doesn't have the credibility for these decisions to be made on what he's testified about. He lied too about it. Their exhibits 137 through 140 are payments that were of the clear and established pattern of the parties to pay off the HELOC. The parties would write a check to Mr. Off, which he would accept, deposit into his account, and from that same personal account, apply the payment to the HELOC, which was in his name alone. The HELOC was not a joint account. And the parties from 2008 to 2013 at least paid that amount in full using that method. Now, he represented to have paid that amount off, and my client had no idea that it wasn't paid off until divorce proceedings. Another deceitful action of Mr. Off is that he ran to the tax office and filed his taxes single, despite the parties always filing their taxes married in 2015, leaving my client to claim all the income, though he admitted using that income. Another item I'd like to address is memorializing the gift. Saying that we have to memorialize a gift every time we have a personal conversation with a parent or a grandparent, it doesn't make sense. It's unreasonable. Your Honor, if we say that, then every time you have a conversation with a friend or family member about a gift they're planning to give someone, you have to go write that down and keep it safe in case it becomes an issue later. Mr. Jankowski was acting.
Well, counsel, to that point, it does seem that these examples are ones when you're talking about real estate, when you're talking about a gift, that it does go beyond the pale of something that you would normally do where it wouldn't be documented at all. But gifts typically are documented, if at a minimum, for the fact that you have, if you want to acknowledge that for tax purposes, you need to have some type of documentation for gifts. So yes. It does seem that gifts would be something that you would want to have some type of documentation for.
Yes, Your Honor, and I do believe that Ms. Jankowski acted ethically and that she advised her grandmother to speak with an Arizona tax attorney. She specifically stated she's not a practicing attorney, tax law's not in her wheelhouse. It would be unethical for her to advise her grandmother on that.
Right, and that I don't have any issue with that. My issue is the lack of documentation to show donative intent.
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe it's the facts and actions that show the donative intent. So I see I'm out of time, so I'm respectfully requesting this court to recalculate and redetermine the marital equity and debts by applying the Schmitz formula. I believe the court has everything it needs to do that, and to overturn the decision of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you to both counsel. Let me see, am I on or am I off?
You're on.
Somehow the little icons at the bottom of my screen don't show up to indicate. There they are. Thank you for your argument. Thank you for your briefing and the oral argument today, and for your accommodating these unusual circumstances and appearing by virtual technology. It's much appreciated. The matter is submitted. We have then taken it under advisement, and we will issue an opinion within the statutory period. And with that, the court is in recess until our next oral argument.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Okay, I will move you all back to the lobby until we're ready to start.
How exciting.